We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
In late June, the FBI announced that it had broken up a network of Russian spies that had been living for years in the United States. They were assigned, said the FBI, to settle down and blend in with the hope that they might one day form contacts that would then lead to secret information. The case, if nothing else, served as a reminder that espionage did not end with the fall of the Soviet Union and that governments around the world are still intent on learning each other's secrets. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about intelligence gathering in the post-Cold War era, how it did or did not change with the end of the Cold War, who it is that is spying on whom today. And our guest for the program is James Wirtz. He is the Dean of the School of International Graduate Studies and professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. There, he teaches courses on nuclear strategy, international relations theory, and intelligence, and has done a lot of writing on these subjects. We're pleased that he could spend a little time with us talking this morning, and we certainly would tell people who are listening that if you want to call in with questions, you may. But please, keep it to a question. Keep it as brief as you can. Keep it on the topic, and that will help us make space for as many different people as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. Is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do also have email, so if you'd like to send your thoughts that way, you can write will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, certainly, questions are welcome. Professor Wirtz, hello.
Morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us, so we certainly appreciate it. I want to start out and maybe talk a little bit about this particular case. I guess if it had not been for that story, we wouldn't have thought about having a conversation like this. As people will recall, I think altogether 11 people were identified, not only identified as Russian agents, but they were deported. It seems that they didn't come up with any big secrets. And weren't really in a position to. So the most that the government could do is charge them with being unregistered agents of a foreign government. Some people seem to want to make a joke about this and say, well, that says something about how ineffectual the Russian intelligence effort today is. Other people said, no, don't. That is the wrong conclusion to draw from this. What do you make out of all of this?
Well, you know, the idea of having a sleeper cell, that's sort of a traditional fear for counterintelligence agents and for, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States. The idea that a foreign government or foreign, entity or, a criminal or terrorist network would put a sleeper cell, what that is, are agents that are intended to go and blend in, sort of hide in plain sight and become a part of the local community. And usually you would think they'd have a specific target in mind, that they would want to penetrate a certain agency or gain a certain position or befriend certain people. So the idea that, the sleeper cells are out there or that, people are blending in isn't really, it just goes to show it's not all that far-fetched. And in a way, the 9/11 conspirators were also a sleeper cell. They were brought into the country to accomplish a mission over a period of time and to blend in. So on the one hand, the Russian agents didn't seem to have a particularly well-developed target. They didn't have a specific mission in mind. They were just supposed to go out there and gather information. But the idea that it's a technique that's used by foreign intelligence to gather information or to influence American policy is not all far-fetched.
Hmm. Well, do we know that, let's say, for example, just say Russia.
Right.
Do we have reason to believe that there would be people like this who were living in other countries who had the same mission?
Sure, I'm sure there are. You would figure that there were targets probably throughout NATO. Western Europe, the UK would be targeted. Canada would be targeted. Probably in the Far East to a certain extent. You would think that if they tried this technique here, they'd probably practice it against other intelligence targets they think that are of interest.
Hmm. Then I suppose the next question that people would have is: Does the United States have people like this living in other countries?
I don't know. I mean, that would be, I don't know. I don't have any information about that. But, you know, usually this is these are, I don't think the U.S. government uses, these people are overseas without any official cover. There's probably a tendency not to do that because it's very dangerous. You know, if you get picked up, you'd be, you know, shot at the spy.
For the individuals, it would be very dangerous.
Right. And so if you would do these sort of things, you would probably want to do it only under, you know, extreme circumstances where there's a real known, you know, there's a well-defined reason to do it. But this sort of fishing expedition strikes me as, you know, as it turned out for the Russia case, wasn't all that productive.
Yeah. What about do we have reason to believe that there might be other countries? China, for example, or perhaps other countries who would have similar kind of agents in the United States.
Yes, that would be the fear that, you know, this technique is not really practiced alone by the Russians. It's that it's a well-known intelligence technique to sort of put sleeper cells in, have agents hide in plain sight, use cover stories, pretend to be one thing when, in fact, they're serving another mission. So this practice really is common across, you know, you'd almost want to say all intelligence agencies. It's a well-known technique that's probably used by many countries.
Mm-hmm. Something that I came across in one of the articles that I read, though, I thought was kind of interesting, is that at least the thrust of this particular article was that technology actually makes it more difficult to do this today, or to do clandestine work, because it makes it much harder to be unnoticed, to escape surveillance, to maintain a false identity. Doing this, what the Russians have done, to be one of these quote unquote illegals, that in fact the days of being able to do that are drawing to a close.
Well, you're right, and it's very difficult to do these sorts of things. And the problem is the digital. Sort of the digital signature that accompanies all of us in the information age, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got a bank account, a mortgage, a car loan, all kinds of records. And those records interact in ways that are impossible to predict. You don't know what form requires what data is related to what form requires what data. And all this information is digitized. So when it comes time to present a false front, you not only have to present the false front in terms of your physical appearance or the way you look, the way you talk, where you live, you also have that digital false front. And that's very, very, very difficult to recreate. If you think about it, if somebody looks into your background and all of a sudden all of your digital records end 3 years ago, and there's no trace of a bank account, you know, college record, et cetera, et cetera, it becomes highly suspicious.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with James Wirtz. He's dean of the School of International Graduate Studies and professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. I tell you, Professor Wirtz, we're a little unhappy with the quality of the phone connection. I'm kind of thinking maybe we're going to try to put the call through again and see if maybe that would get us a little bit better.
Okay.
So we'll put you back on hold here, and Jason at the controls will do that for us. And then I can just, mention the fact that our guest, James Wirtz, teaches courses on nuclear strategy, on international relations theory, and also on intelligence. And he has done a lot of writing on all of these subjects in his capacity there at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And we're talking this morning about intelligence and about how things did or did not change when it comes to spying in the post-Cold War era. And our reason for, I suppose, starting to think about this was, in fact, this story that came back in June, and I'm sure that you'll remember it. 12 individuals were named by the U.S. government as being agents of Russia, that they were living here, carrying on their lives in the United States, supposed to be doing what they could to blend in. But the idea was that it might give them the opportunity to make contacts that would then lead to information. The FBI found them, deported them, and apparently they didn't learn any secrets. As I said, what they were charged with was being agents of a foreign government, unregistered agents of a foreign government. They were deported. Then, in fact, there was a swap. We got some people that the Russians were holding, and we sent these Russians home. And it started a lot of people to think about, ask questions about, well, what sort of spying goes on today? And that's what we thought we'd maybe try to talk about. Questions, again, are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have you back, Professor Wirtz. Thanks for being patient with us there.
No problem.
That sounds a lot better. That's okay. Excellent. I suppose one wonders, my assumption would be that when the Cold War was on, the countries that were investing the most in intelligence would have been the United States and would have been the Soviet Union. So the question is, after the Cold War, now if you ask what countries are putting the most into intelligence gathering, I expect the United States still probably would be the biggest one, but that there would be others. Russia and China, I would think, would be pretty high on the list. But is it possible to say something about that?
Well, you would think Russia and China would be pretty high on the list. And I think, you know, the French have a reputation for putting a lot of effort into intelligence gathering. The Israelis do. But there's a long list. Pakistan, India have significant intelligence establishments. So pretty much everywhere you look, countries devote some effort towards intelligence gathering or maintain an intelligence agency, if for no other reason than, and this is sort of strange too, to actually have a liaison relationship with other intelligence organizations.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So in a way, it's kind of strange that a country might not have much interest in intelligence gathering or analysis, but in order to be able to communicate with other organizations, intelligence organizations, they actually maintain an intelligence establishment.
As far as the Russians are concerned, it seemed that immediately after the Cold War, there seemed to be something of a de-emphasis. The effort to restructure the KGB, which was the Russian equivalent of the CIA, split its responsibilities up, perhaps make it more of a research organization and less of a covert operations organization, and that then, though, things really turned around again when Mr. Putin came to power, having been a former KGB man. And some people pointed to this, again, the Russian sleepers here in the United States, as being some sort of indication that his priorities were to, in a sense, reconstitute the KGB, and that while it has a new name now, that what he had in mind was for it to be very much like what it was.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, because, you know, during the Cold War, the Russians, the Soviets, didn't really maintain much of an analytical capability, you know, or an analytic capability, in the sense that there was no sort of social science tradition where they would gather information, analyze it, interpret it, try to, you know, understand the deeper meaning behind it, and then disseminate that information to policymakers. Soviet intelligence really was about clandestine collection of secrets or espionage. So their idea of intelligence was that they would go and try to find bits and pieces of information and simply feed it into the leadership without much analysis, without adding much context. It was really reporting on secrets that were discovered in the course of their espionage activities. There really wasn't much of an analytic capability. And this current sort of episode sort of harkens back to that earlier day, because here you have people who are sort of spread out across American society trying to meet influential Americans so they can report back what they find. Truth be told, you probably learn as much in the press about what's going on as you would from these sort of private contacts. So that really is a return to the way I think things were in the former Soviet Union. It's that sort of tradition or that culture of intelligence as practiced in the Soviet Union. You could see that evidence of that in this latest episode.
And though, does that then, you have to ask a question about why they would do that. Is that because they think that was valuable, or is that because that was, in a sense, a part of their mindset? That was just the way that people thought. And so what's happening is that we're bringing individuals, Mr. Putin in particular, back into power, and he's just doing the way he always thought and people who trained him always thought they should be done. Not so much that you wonder whether they actually think they're going to get very much out of this.
You know, I agree with you, and that's a great, you know, dissertation question for doctoral dissertation. I mean, what's driving this behavior? Is it, you know, personalities involved? Is it organizational culture? Is that lingering culture? Or is it maybe more of a strategic, you know, a long-term national culture, or strategic culture that's playing out here, sort of the quest to look for secrets and to ferret out this information from individuals? I mean, that's a good question. And, you know, during the Cold War, there were competing explanations for why this would occur this way.
Hmm. Given that there is so much information that's now available electronically, and I'm sure that an individual could do a lot in terms of intelligence gathering with, as long as they had an internet connection,
right,
they're ready to go. And that there's much in that you can find out that way, and probably a lot more you can find out that way than as time goes along, more and more. Then also, though, particularly after 9/11, people raised this question, well, had we gone too far in emphasizing that as a way of gathering intelligence? And have we lost the ability to actually send people in to do what we always thought of as spying,
right,
like James Bond kind of spying,
right,
where you take a person and you send them somewhere, and they physically go and they try to find out what they can and talk to whoever they can? And is there still a role for that kind of gathering, and have we de-emphasized that?
Well, you know, the turn away from sort of what's called human intelligence or human, and that's sort of that, you know, individuals on the ground actually using human beings to collect information, actually occurred in the 1970s. What happened in the 70s, there's a lot of, you know, satellite technology and space reconnaissance capabilities are coming online. And what happened is human collection was de-emphasized and technical collection vastly increased. And, you know, depending on what you're looking at, if you're looking at major military formations or major weapon systems being built, you know, satellite reconnaissance can tell you a good deal of information. I mean, there's certain pieces of information that you need a human being for, but on balance, those technical collection systems work very well. But what happens is that there is, in a sense, the intelligence community is hit three different problems emerge. One is the information revolution, that there's enormous amounts of information now out there. There are whole new venues for activity. You know, the internet itself is a realm of activity. There's all this information that has to be monitored. So in a way, technical monitoring becomes more important. A second problem is the kinds of targets, kinds of the entities we're interested in have less to do with major military formations or major weapon programs, but now we're talking about clandestine cells, terrorist groups, criminal networks, and those things are very difficult to monitor using satellite in outer space. So you actually need those human connections, those human collectors out there to look at that information. But the problem is the intelligence community, the U.S. intelligence community, is not well positioned to do that. One reason is they haven't emphasized it for a long time. And second, that, you know, you need agents in place that can blend in with local populations, and that takes time to recruit those people, to develop those people, either as U.S. citizens or people on the ground. So in a way, human intelligence is very important against the targets we want to collect against, and we're not particularly well positioned to do that right now. Mm.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this part of Focus, and we'll go on and we'll take a call. James Wirtz is dean at the School of International Graduate Studies and also professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, where he teaches courses on nuclear strategy, international relations theory, and intelligence. He also was section chair of the Intelligence Studies section of the International Studies Association and has done a lot of writing on the areas that I mentioned, international relations, nuclear strategy, intelligence. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I appreciate the host asking the question if the U.S. does this kind of thing. And I just find it kind of boggling to think that someone who's at the Monterey Institute, where the agency and the various agencies, CIA, use it for its language instruction, the kind of instruction that would be entirely appropriate for the kind of people that do get inserted in places around the world. So I'm not very hopeful about getting anything in the way of a informative response here. But I did want to take the opportunity, since you are talking about after the Cold War, well, one of the places where I guess one might say, I wouldn't, but the Cold War is still ongoing is U.S.-Cuba relations, and I think the Cuban Five is a very important, captures a lot about what the spy versus spy world is really about, and I've heard interesting people in D.C. admit that the Cuban Five were not spying on the U.S. They were spying on paramilitary groups who were actually exploding bombs in hotels in Cuba, and that the U.S. tried them as if it was a national secret and as if it was national policy. Now, well, maybe that's true. Maybe that is true, that that the U.S. did back these terrorist attacks on hotels to diminish tourism. And but the Cuban Five were not spying on the U.S. They were spying on the rightist groups in Miami and around the area, and they had a deep insertion in that. And it just this controversy people can find the trial judge, the appeal judge, wrote a long tract suggesting that these kind of facts. But no, they went ahead, and these people are now in life jails. There's some talk around the edges in Washington of having some kind of swap with Cuba too for these five guys who were basically just, they weren't spying on the U.S. It's astonishing. And again, I'm sort of talking to the audience because I really don't know what kind of reaction I'll get from somebody from the Monterey Institute who doesn't know that language acquisition by the CIA is going on around STEM. Cheers.
All right. Well, Professor Wirtz, you respond however you want.
Sure. Well, what he's really talking about is the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, and that's a DOD. It's a DOD schoolhouse that right now there are probably about 2,000 students, and it really ranges from all ranks. There's enlisted personnel, and then there are officers who are generally foreign area officers. And it is an immersion program. It's actually a world-class immersion program to teach all kinds of languages there. But, you know, the people being educated in language there aren't all, or, you know, they're not being educated to be sort of parachuted as clandestine sleeper agents at the, you know, denied areas around the planet. Most of these people are linguists who are there to help, you know, translate and understand for example, you know, all that information that, you know, is gleaned off the Internet. If you're going to read an Internet site in a foreign language, you got to be able to read it, that sort of thing. So most of that are there are linguists there for to be able to translate information that's already gathered, or they're being trained to serve as, you know, for attachés or foreign area officers in around the world. Now, I'm not familiar with the Cuban Five case. So I don't have really much to say about that. I can't comment on that. I'm not familiar with the details. Mm.
And just, you know, the caller made reference to the fact I asked you, well, you know, do we know whether there are American sleeper cells like this Russian sleeper cells? And you just said, well, you didn't know that there were. I imagine, though, you would probably say, well, it wouldn't surprise you if there were.
No, it wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, the tradecraft sort of varies from country to country, and I don't think, you know, in the history of this, there are not a lot of examples, or none come to mind where there is sort of what you're talking about is different kinds of cover that is used when it comes time to put agents in the field. Is it with official cover or non-official cover? You know, do you just go as Joe Citizen? Or, you know, Mr. Businessman and go into the country and go and make a life for the next 30, 40 years for yourself. You know, I don't know of any cases. I've never encountered a case where the U.S. government has actually put a person, a U.S. citizen, into a foreign land and said, now you're going to be a sleeper agent and come back in the next 50 years. I just don't know of any case like that in the intelligence literature. I've never run across the U.S. government ever doing that.
But I'm sure that they have tried to take advantage of the fact that there are Americans who are living and working abroad who may indeed have information that would be valuable to the United States.
Sure.
And they would want, you know, to the extent that they had the opportunity to talk to people like that and you know, find out what they know.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, what we're really talking about here is something completely different, that you put somebody to really lead their life in a foreign country under a false pretense for the purposes of intelligence collection. I mean, we're really talking about leading major portions of your life to really blend in, you know, go overseas, marry into the society, get employed into society, join that society with another mission in mind. And they're really, as far as I've never encountered a case of that in the literature. Mm. You know, no one's ever reported that back.
One thing certainly we do know is that countries, not only do they spy on their enemies, they spy on their friends.
Well, yes, Yes, I mean, that's one of the strange things about intelligence, not only spy on your friends, but to actually use it as a means of communication. Remember, I mentioned a little earlier about intelligence organizations being created to actually communicate with other countries through, you know, intelligence channels. So it's generally not known, but there is a good deal of communication that occurs between countries through intelligence channels via, you know, maybe competing or even at times antagonistic intelligence organizations.
Well, that's, I guess in my mind, there would be a difference between between the intelligence agencies, representatives of two different countries, just sitting down and exchanging information where their interests align. The difference between that and actually doing what's full out spying.
Right.
I'm thinking that though both of those things must indeed go on.
Oh, sure, absolutely. So, but yeah, even there are. I think there are. Maybe the best way to look at it is there are degrees of cooperation or conflict among intelligence organizations. Some are engaged more cooperative arrangements. Some are more conflictual. But it's always a mix. Even among the bitterest enemies, intelligence organizations are sometimes used as a conduit for sort of open and honest communication.
Mm-hmm. I have an email here just now on this subject from someone who was wondering, do you have any information or informed guesses about the extent of Israeli espionage activities in the United States?
You know, there were several high-profile cases. I guess the Pollard case a few years ago is one of them, mm-hmm. where people sympathetic to the Israeli cause passed information they weren't supposed to, you know, classified information they weren't cleared to pass on to Israeli intelligence. Whether or not those people were deliberately cultivated or they were, you know, maybe acting out of conscience people debate about that. But those cases do seem to be people who took it upon themselves to do that, and they weren't necessarily cultivated by Israeli intelligence.
Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, James Wirtz, is dean at the School of International Graduate Studies and also professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School, Monterey, California, where he teaches courses on nuclear strategy, international relations theory, intelligence. We're talking about spying, intelligence gathering in the post-Cold War era. Questions are welcome. Well, I would imagine that things did change, or at least at the end of the Cold War, the government, U.S. government, would have decided that maybe what they needed to do was reallocate resources a little bit differently, and that then, though probably the next major change, a huge change, would have been 9/11. And I wonder if you have some thoughts about those two change points at the end of the Cold War and then 9/11, and how things changed at those two points.
Well, you know, during the Cold War, the intelligence problem U.S. faced, I mean, it was relatively simple. I mean, the real problem, people would argue, but the real problem was that it was Soviet military power, and it was Soviet military capability that had to be tracked and monitored. And that's, you're talking about very large military units, very large infrastructure. So the focus is really on that Soviet military capability. Other things, you know, Soviet allies, well, it was easy to track them too because they all used Soviet equipment. They were all influenced by Soviet military doctrine. So that was really the main focus of U.S. intelligence, was the Soviet Union, and everything after that was sort of a lesser included threat. After the Soviet Union, the problem faced by the intelligence community really, things become very difficult. The problem is that the threat now sort of dissipates. It comes from a variety of directions. It's not as severe, you know. It's sort of relatively small threats, but they come from a variety of directions. So the problem really becomes, how do you allocate resources across this whole threat environment to know where the next real problem is coming from? And I think the intelligence community worked on that problem throughout the 1990s. And by the end of the 1990s, certain the nature of the problem began to emerge. That notion of non-state actors was on that horizon. There was a notion that in certain parts of the world, there was a lack of governance, there was a lack of, you know, legitimate authority over certain areas of the world, and that out of these sort of collapsed areas or collapsing areas, problems would emerge, and those problems would transcend international boundaries. The problem then becomes, how does the U.S. intelligence system going to deal with that? And there was a recognition that the U.S. was not well positioned to deal with that threat, because we either had intelligence organizations focused on the outside internationally, and we had domestic police organizations like the Federal Bureau of Investigation that were focused internally, but there was really a divide between the external and the internal. In that divide, that seam in those organizations is what Al-Qaeda exploited on 9/11.
That, I guess I'm still thinking about, you know, this interesting business of now we're in this world where you can gather so much intelligence from a computer screen, but that here now, again, because of these changes, human intelligence becomes much more valuable, and yet at the same time, the kind of challenges involved in trying to penetrate, well, say what you're trying to do is investigate a group like Al-Qaeda.
Right.
The idea of placing an agent in Al-Qaeda seems like next to impossible. Maybe not impossible, but, you know, to be able to penetrate an organization like that is extremely, extremely difficult. And that seems like that kind of challenge is going to be, we're going to be facing more and more of that kind of challenge.
No, that's correct. And in fact, a lot of these organizations, they understand, you know, that we're trying to penetrate these organizations. So their security, their operational security is very high. They're very attuned to penetration. And, you know, as an agent, if you were going to penetrate that organization, you'd have to establish, as they would say in the intelligence community, your bona fides to the bad guys. And sort of how much, you know, criminal activity would you have to participate in order before they took you seriously is an open question. And, you know, does the U.S. government want to be involved in sponsoring agents that are, you know, basically behave as criminals to gain access to these things? You can think of the host of moral, legal issues that would raise trying to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm just something else. Again, this I guess this connects to intelligence in the post 9/11. Era, whether you might have some reaction to this story just recently that's been investigative study that's been done by the folks at the Washington Post,
right,
about the enormous growth of the intelligence gathering apparatus here in the United States, just how many people there are now who are doing this kind of work, and how many separate places that the growth has truly been astounding since 9/11.
There's no doubt, there's no arguing that it's not a huge intelligence enterprise. But in looking at the charts, the way that the Post presented this, what happens is it's sort of that same principle how internationally intelligence organizations communicate with each other. You know, in any government organization, if any government organization wants to participate in that intelligence enterprise, either by providing information to the intelligence enterprise or taking information from the intelligence enterprise, you need your own intelligence organization to do that. You need your own people with the clearances, with the communication networks to participate. So I think that's one point in the Post where they didn't quite understand that there are many organizations out there producing intelligence, but there are also many organizations that consume intelligence, and all of them need some intelligence element inside them in order to do that communication.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, with the proliferation of communication links and classification, you actually have to set up your own intelligence cell in an organization to participate in the whole intelligence activity.
One of the things that I suppose got a lot of people thinking was the incredible growth in the number of people and the different agencies and
right,
and different places that were doing this. Almost so many that no one really before this, maybe even since, no one really knows exactly how many. And it makes you wonder how do you keep track of, if all you're interested in is making sure money is well spent,
right,
you know, how do you keep track of your budgets, but also how to be effective, there has to be coordination between
right,
all of these various people, and whether you get to the point where it gets so big that that becomes very, very difficult.
You know, those are good questions, and they're all in the realm of possibility. I mean, there comes a point where it's just so vast that no one really does know who works there or what's going on, or who's responsible for what sort of information or analysis under what circumstances. I think part of this is you get the strange, the unfortunate combination of 9/11 and the sort of the information revolution, and especially with the information revolution, the impact it's having on society and on sort of government is obviously not completely known. And one of the problems you're running into is that there's a proliferation of organizations simply trying to develop situational awareness of what's going on, given the surge of information that's available.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're having at the same time, there's sort of an explosion in terms of the information revolution. It's not surprising that there'd be sort of explosion in government entities attempting to monitor that information.
Mm. One of the things that was really striking about this was not only the fact that there are now, according to the Post, something now more than 1,200 government organizations working on counterterrorism efforts.
Right.
There are also more than 1,900 private companies doing that, and which will again raise a lot of questions about oversight and perhaps also about security.
Well, that turn towards sort of, contracting out, the contracting phenomena, really occurred, is a longstanding trend. That really started in the early 1990s, at the end of the Cold War, where there's a general downsizing of personnel, and there was a shift, there was an idea of for search for economy, that it was cheaper to contract out a lot of these functions than it was to actually employ government workers. Now, the pendulum has swung the other way now, and there's more of an emphasis across government to hiring more government workers and sort of getting rid of the contractors. But that's a fair point. There are some cost savings with the contractors, but there are oversight issues. One fundamental issue is you would hope that in terms of the government, the government worker would be more interested in serving the needs of the government and putting that above profit, whereas a corporate entity always has to keep that profit motive in mind. Mm-hmm. That would be one big decision. Mm-hmm. One big difference between the two sorts of entities.
Yeah. I realize we've touched on this, but again, I guess I'm thinking about the coordination issues that you go back to 9/11. This is the failure to connect the dots.
Right.
Well, we had an even smaller number of players there who had information who couldn't work together.
Right.
Now, I know the Defense Secretary, Mr. Gates, in response to this whole thing, said, well, he didn't think that we'd gotten something that was so big no one could manage it.
Right.
But you still have to wonder about when you get that many different people who are collecting information, whether it's a nearly impossible task or maybe just much more difficult task to have some kind of somebody at the top who can see what everybody's doing and see how things do fit together.
You know, that's one of the dilemmas here is that it's virtually guaranteed that no matter what the next intelligence problem, whether it's a success or a failure, there will always be information in the intelligence pipeline. And with the intelligence community of this size, it's virtually guaranteed that there'll be clear signals, clear evidence, clear, accurate, and timely evidence of what's about to happen somewhere in that intelligence infrastructure. Whether or not you could pull that out in time, pass it to officials so they could act on it in a timely manner, that's the big question. But the problem is if you downsize, well, maybe you won't have the agencies out there to collect that data, so maybe next time the problem will be, well, it's not that we have the data inside, we just couldn't get our hands on it. No, next time we're too small to collect the data, process it, provide it to the people who need it. You're sort of doomed to make one mistake or the other. But clearly, after 9/11, the pendulum has shifted to growth, large, we'll collect everything and sort it out. But that only tells us that the pendulum now will probably swing backwards we'll begin moving towards a leaner, more efficient, better coordinated agency or intelligence enterprise. But will it have the capacity to collect the information it needs to? That'll be a question for a talk show 10 years from now.
Right. We have about 10 minutes or so in this part of Focus. And for anyone who's just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again the guest, James Wirtz. He's the dean at the School of International Graduate Studies and professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, where he teaches courses on nuclear strategy, international relations theory, and intelligence. And we're talking about intelligence gathering in the post-Cold War era. Who spies on whom today? That was the title we put on the show. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And also, you may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's a caller over in Indiana. We'll get them on our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Two things. The first thing is I just simply have one heck of a time trying to figure out why they put these people in the United States, and nothing came of it. You mentioned about the distinctions, how things were changing with the KGB, and the different ways they were going about collecting information and stuff. I was wondering if you could get into that a little bit more. It just seems so senseless. You know, it's like maybe the guy sitting next to me in my graduate level course is a Russian spy and wants to know me because 12 years from now I'll be Secretary of State. It somehow just doesn't all click together, even if you put it down logically. There just seems to be gaps everywhere. And secondly, I wish you'd make some comment about and the leak and what it will do to transform a lot of things. There's a lot of talk now that other countries won't trust us because we can't keep control of our own secrets. And names were mentioned, and Al-Qaeda is now taking care of those people. And I'm against that sort of thing. I don't put myself right out there. I'm against the war, too. But we've got men there, and I want to keep them safe as possible. And I don't think this sort of thing is even sensible. But I wish you'd make some comment about that, how to structure something in the future in terms of intelligence gathering, or at least, you know, letting the information out in some ways. Thank you.
All right. The caller was breaking up a little bit there, but I'm clear he was referring to the recent WikiLeaks case.
Sure.
And so whatever you might want to say about
sure.
that.
Sure. You know, that's actually, you know, that those WikiLeaks really are a phenomenon of the information revolution, because if you think about it, 70,000 documents, even if they're one page a piece, if it was the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War, I mean, Daniel Ellsberg had to photocopy that. I mean, you had to copy that. You had to hand carry it out. You couldn't hand carry 70,000 pages out the door. You couldn't photocopy it all. Somebody would notice that. So this really is an information age phenomenon. And I think it shows the one issue is that there's so much data on those official systems, it creates a problem in and of itself. I mean, this leak is a leak of unimaginable proportions. It's an unimaginable, so much classified data or potentially classified data could have been put out on the Internet. It's really remarkable. And the only way you could do that these days is because of the information revolution. You know, to put some sort of, thumb drive or a CD-ROM or somehow inadvertently, swap hard drives and carry it out the door. That's really an information revolution phenomenon. It really does do damage. What I've been led to believe is most of those reports are sort of relatively mundane after-action reports. The intelligence value is sort of fleeting. You know, the idea that maybe this is a report that says we went on a patrol on this day in this area and we saw nothing. Well, there's not much intelligence value there. But to the extent that those documents does contain information about people who cooperated with U.S. or allied forces, and that it would be possible to identify those people, that is really very obviously very damaging, and does put our credibility with our friends, allies, in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. Just real quick, one thing I guess I do want to mention, because we talked recently, we've done a couple of shows where these issues came up, and we have another one coming up on Thursday. And again, for people who are interested in, hearing different kinds of viewpoints on this, Jeff Stone will talk with us. He's professor of law at University of Chicago Law School, about the issue of government secrecy. And he's someone who really makes the argument that things should be as open as possible. I don't know where he would want to draw lines. But anyway, we'll have some more about that on the show Thursday at 10. To get back to the other question that the caller raised, and I think that, again, when people read the story of the Russian 10 or 11 or 12, whatever a number you pick, that As I said at the beginning, they apparently didn't come up with any serious information. In fact, they weren't really charged with spying. That when you look at these people and the lives that they were leading, you had to ask yourself the question, what made anybody think that they could come up with anything that would be useful in terms of secret information?
You know, sometimes, maybe this is hard for maybe the listeners to understand, but sometimes our culture, the way we view the world, doesn't really correspond with reality. And I think in terms of the Russian intelligence culture, the idea that they could put a sleeper cell in the United States and to have them interact in relatively sort of benign social and political circles, the idea that you might run into somebody in a even relatively high government position in some sort of social setting and influence them or gather information, I think that's really more of a reflects more of their mindset and the way they view the world and the way they believe that things work in the United States. And it's maybe not the way they really do work, or it's not all that productive, but maybe this is what they really believe. I mean, that's the best answer I can come up with.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Chicago. They're next, line four. Hello.
America's U.S. foreign policy, to the extent that America's military and espionage budgets have represented a gargantuan investment in our eventual outcome for all the countries, and who knows what kind of Armageddon it might involve. But the U.S. portrays itself as a global cop, keeping order in an otherwise chaotic and dangerous world. But in reality, America's youth, military, and other things are portrayed as seeking out the world's resources. So essentially, our foreign policy, stating we will go to war to maintain our access to oil, is the main issue, along with other things, human rights and other values. But resources seems to be the name of the game for all the countries, whatever espionage or trade policies they have. So I thought I'd offer that as a comment.
All right. Well, I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. Resource, the study of resources, natural resources, there's a whole list of issues. Natural resources, environmental change, issues of pollution. There's a whole demographics. There's a whole list of issues that have emerged and become increasingly important in really since the end of the Cold War. And part of those are whole new fields for intelligence. So, I mean, the idea that the study of resources and consumption resources and trends in global resources and energy production, I mean, these are all topics studied by the intelligence community.
We're coming down here. We got just a couple of minutes left. Again, one of the things I suppose I find myself thinking about is that nowadays there is so much information that is available. That's generally, it's publicly available. It's in the public domain if one knows how and where to look.
Right.
And if you add to that the fact that someone who is skilled at going after information that is secure may be able to, again, get down to another deep level, you wonder how difficult it is to keep anything secret. And given that there was so much information that's in the public domain, what constitutes a secret today? I mean, what sort of things would you really want to keep secret or need to keep secret?
Well, traditionally the intelligence community talks about sources and methods, right? They want to keep, sources secret. So in other words, if you do have an agent in a foreign government or you do have, some espionage activity or you have a good satellite that, satellite reconnaissance or listening devices, those sources you want to keep secret. That's one thing. The other thing they talk about is methods. What are your analytical methods? What are your tradecraft? How do you operate? So they want to they talk always about keeping those sources and methods secret. And that's one reason why, classification exists, is because they don't want to give the opponent insight into how they do their business. Another kind of secret would be what really is U.S. government, the bottom line U.S. government opinion or information on a subject. Often that's kept secret. Another thing that's kept secret is, military information that could compromise military operation, compromise the success of the operation, cost American lives or lives of American friends. That's often kept secret. But, beyond that, there probably is a whole realm of information. I mean, there is overclassification in the American intelligence system. Things that should never be classified as secret or classified secret. And in part, when you do that, it sort of increases the cachet of the material. And the higher the classification, the more important sometimes people think it is, and maybe somebody will read it. If it's not classified at a high level, they'll say, well, how important can it be?
So sometimes something that really isn't particularly valuable might somehow get take on the air of something that's valuable simply because it's secret.
That's right. And, you know, I'm sure if the listeners ever saw, you know, or ever were privileged to see a top secret document or, you know, pick 10 of these things at random, I bet you they'd be surprised to find out how mundane some of this stuff really is and how, you know, there really is overclassification in the U.S. system.
Yeah. Is that something that you think is likely to change?
You know, that's one of the hardest things to change, because that's part of the American intelligence culture now, that there is this culture. The culture is of secrecy in the sense that the what gives them their cachet is the idea they're trading in information. They'll come and give you, Mr. Policymaker, information that you really can't get anywhere else, and that's what makes it valuable, and that's what makes them valuable. So that's part of the American culture, intelligence culture, and that's one of classification.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to our guest, James Wirtz. He is Dean of the School of International Graduate Studies and also Professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Professor Wirtz, thank you very much.
Thank you.